Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company. Learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Hope everyone's doing safe, checking in with themselves, with loved ones, taking the space you need, and just, you know, it's pretty nuts out there. So please take a moment for your mental health and well-being. If you need resources, please head to heritageradionetwork.org. We were so excited to sit down with one of the coolest bookstores in America, Print, a bookstore out of Portland, Maine. They invited us to sit down and chat about our own book, Snacky Tunes, Music is the Main Ingredient. And we sat down with Print's Josh Christie and also author Brianna Volk. And we had a great conversation about some stories from the book, some of the inspirations of what went into it. We shared some of our favorite recipes, our favorite music, and it was just a great, great, great conversation. So we are sharing it now in its entirety on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Alrighty, thank you everyone for virtually attending tonight. I have a short introduction just while everyone files in, and then we'll get started. I'm Gracie. I'm the events coordinator for Print. A few housekeeping details. If you have any questions, please feel free to enter them in the chat box, which is on the bottom right, or in the question and answer function on the bottom bar of your screen. If you'd like a copy of tonight's book, I can include the link to the Print page in the chat box. You can click right on through. And now for tonight's speakers. A lifelong Mainer, Josh Christie has been an independent bookseller for over 16 years. In addition to being a partner at Print, a bookstore, Josh is a freelance writer and has written 4 books on beer and the Maine outdoors. Brianna Volk is a writer and restaurateur. She has written 2 cookbooks, Northern Hospitality and Wonder Woman, the official cookbook. Her restaurant, the Portland Hunt and Alpine Club, is a multi-James Beard Foundation semifinalist for Outstanding Bar Program and was named by Thrillist as one of the best cocktail bars in America. Brianna is currently working on her newest cookbook, Northern Daughter, and a new restaurant called Verna's All Day, set to open in Waterville, Maine. Since 2001, Darren Bresnitz has worked in culinary media, focusing on the people in the industry, their stories, and the incredible food and drinks they provide. He has developed and directed numerous cooking shows, like IFC's Dinner with the Band. In 2014, he created the concept for Refinery 29's 29 Rooms, and in 2016, he joined Tastemade, where he currently works as the director of original series, creating series like Cooking with Pride and In the Shadow Of. Since 2009, he has co-hosted and co-produced Heritage Radio Network's Snacky Tunes with his twin brother, Greg, and their best friend, Kwong. Raised from an early age of listening to the radio from the backseat on family road trips, Greg Bresnitz stepped into his first on-air booth at the age of 19. After producing IFC's award-winning cooking and music series, Dinner at the Band, Greg began a career in hospitality. Working for international brands such as Ace Hotel and Selena, Greg built award-winning cultural programs, has launched performance venues, as well as led growth development and property conceptualization. On the podcast Snacky Tunes, he and Greg have interviewed over 1,000 chefs, restaurateurs, bartenders, musicians, artists, and other culinary cohorts. So please join me in virtually welcoming tonight's panel.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Oh.
Hi. Thanks, Gracie. Thank you all for joining us here. Congratulations on all your books. A couple of books launched during a pandemic, which I know is a very difficult thing in a world of virtual book tours and all that. But I have to say that we got connected to do this event because I read an early copy of Snacky Tunes that I got from Fiden, your publisher, and just loved it, and loved it enough that my love of it was picked up by the Boston Globe, which you both saw, and yes, then reached out about.
Thank you.
Of course, absolutely. Well, thanks for this great book. You both got in touch about doing an event, and we have gone forward here along with Brianna, who's a great friend of the store. We did the launch of her last cookbook for the Portland Hunt Alpine Club, and also have the Wonder Woman cookbook at our store, which is great. And wanted to move forward on this conversation about food and music. So if we could start off, Greg and Darren, a little bit about how Snacky Tunes, not even the book yet, but the radio show and podcast came to be.
I've done radio. Well, Darren was actually the first to do radio when we were both at Boston University together. He stopped doing it, but I continued and have done radio in some form or another for the last 20 or so years. Snacky Tunes came together because I was looking for a new home, and we were friends with the people at Roberta's. Darren had come up with Dinner with the Band, and we were looking for just another creative outlet that we could completely control. We met with them. Roberta Heritage Radio Network was originally a just food policy network. And we wanted to do a music show. And they said, you can do a music show as long as you add food into it. And we said, okay. And we came up with the name Snacky Tunes on the spot. And that was 12 years ago. So it was originally digital radio. And then 200 episodes in, I called Darren. I said, I think we're podcasters. They had archived all the episodes. And I was like, oh, I guess that's now we've done this. And so we're going to probably hit episode 500 sometime later this year. And we've been really blessed with having been able to sit down with some of the top culinary names around the world while in having on some of the best up and coming musicians in Los Angeles and New York. That's our history.
Yeah, it's been really great. Every time anyone says yes, it's a little bit of a surprise. And this week we sat down with William Bradley, the chef, 15 years, and just had a great conversation and just, you know, sitting down talking with chefs and musicians and seeing their shared passions and things like that, it never gets old. I mean, we'll hit 500 and we'll look to the next 500, and any way that we can give people space to share their stories and talk about anything they want and give them a unique type of space to tell that story, really, really special to us.
And, you know, born from this long-running radio show, we have a book. And how did you make that transition? Was this something that the publisher and agent reached out to you about turning into a book, or was it an idea that you had and took to them as a more formed idea, or was it something in between?
I was going through a strong bout of depression during the time, and just like kind of was feeling a little bit lost, and went to go visit some friends in Mexico City who were like, you should just turn Snacky Tunes into a book. And I thought, okay, why don't we just transcribe all the old episodes and then we'll just do like a, you know, quote book or something. And then we realized that it was very expensive to transcribe a lot of episodes, and our interviews end up being so personal that we would be really just doing square peg, round hole type of stuff. So we just started anew and focused in on the idea of just, you know, this idea that we discovered over the years of interviews that like chefs and musicians are very much the same people, and that music has played a very outside influence on the culinary world, but it's not really spoken about. It's like here and there, they either used to be musicians or there's music in the kitchen or they refer to their kitchens as orchestras, but it's never been something cohesive. So we decided to pull it together, wrote the proposal. And Emily Takutis, who's a commissioning editor at Faden, she was doing an event, and I just got up the nerve to ask her if she would take a look at the proposal and send it to some of her friends. And she said, well, sure, but can I look at it first? And immediately got very, very nervous because it's Faden, and sent it to her and never looked back. She liked what she saw and she guided us through the process, and we're very, very happy to have a home with them.
And
Oh, sorry, go on.
No, please, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, when putting together a proposal, I think it's good to have inspiration from what you've worked on. And unless you're doing something like you're a restaurant and you're pulling a greatest of hit recipe list for book number one, sometimes you got to look at what you've done and then just use that as a leaping off point. And when we realized that we couldn't go back into the archives, and we were staring down the barrel of what would ultimately become 77 different entries with close to 100 chefs and restaurateurs, were like, we just knew that we had to go back in and redo the work to get something unique and something that was focused. And the way that we did it, to pull back the apron a little bit, was that we just put together about 15 questions for the chefs and the restaurateurs. And we didn't, it was interesting because like we were just asking the questions and sit back, which I think if we had done it maybe earlier in our career, we would have jumped in when they were giving their responses. And it took a lot of patience just to sit back and like talk about all this incredible stuff and not say anything. But you know, it's really their words in the book. We did some editing and we took it from questionnaire into narrative and things like that. But it was great. You know, fade in very early on when we saw the responses back, we're like, oh, they love the idea. They're just looking about execution. And we're like, let's just play cool. And then we can figure out how to do it on the other side once we get the contract signed. Josh, I think you're on mute.
Of course I am. A year into this, I haven't figured it out yet. So apologies.
It's the worst. It gets the worst of all of us.
So format wise, you know, the chapters all, or the pieces all have a similar structure, although there's some differences in that each has, and you can please correct me if I'm wrong, a playlist from the chefs, a recipe from the chefs, and then also some sort of essay, whether it's questions or quotes or any different format in terms of writing. And to bring Brianna into the conversation here, I'm kind of curious about, for Hunt Alpine, if you were looking at a, you know, and Greg and Darren can help me a little bit since they put the book together in terms of phrasing this question, but in terms of talking about how music plays in your kitchen and plays into the recipes you make, I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, as far as, I mean, you know, again, like food and drink for me is always based on mood. And I think, you know, music is the same thing. So anytime like we're creating recipes or trying to put something together, you know, we're trying to play something to kind of match our mood of what we're doing. And I think that really lends to like helping us be more creative. But, you know, there have been so many times where we put something on and then like I've started like I can think, because right now I'm like working on another cookbook. Like I can think about like I was making this recipe and it was supposed to be sweet. And I know that half of it is because of the playlist I was listening to. It turned into a savory recipe. And which is like super cool and it's going to be delicious and great. And it's just kind of like one of those unexpected things of like music kind of opening up how you think about what else you're doing in front of you and how you think about creativity in that sense. And it's always been.
What were you listening to that changed it from savory to sweet?
Well, so we just got home a couple weeks ago, but we spent 9 weeks on the road with our 6-year-old and 3-year-old in a 20-foot Airstream.
Brave.
Just kind of like, it was a thing. It was great. We all like each other still, so we're good. But like, you know, camping out on BLM land, like trying to be as away from people as possible. And so we've been introducing the kids to a lot of like kind of like place music for where we were. And so we were in the Southwest and it was a lot of like John Denver, Rocky Mountain High mixed in with Old Crow Medicine Show, which I do think lends itself to savorier foods when you listen to that a lot.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. That we're doing a lot of cooking with coals and cast iron and Dutch oven and things like that.
Yeah. So we actually installed a combi oven in the Airstream so we could actually like, it's a little dude, but I mean, okay. Yeah, it's like a quarter sheet pan. It's a little guy, okay. But like we took out the microwave and installed that so we could actually do
smart.
Like some baking and, you know, raising doughs and stuff. But a lot of it was cooking outside over an open flame.
There's this old legendary cookbook from the 70s that is all microwave recipes.
Is it the microwave cooking for one?
No, I don't know if it was, I mean, I'm sure there was a couple, but you know, it's like they have like lobster. They have things that are like, now you go, this should never be in a microwave. but steak and lobster, like heavy protein and things like that. But combi oven in the Airstream is hats off. That's what a pro move.
I wouldn't have made it that long.
No.
With just a microwave to cook with.
Mm-mm. No, I mean, having fresh bread or fresh baked goods on the road is something you can really roll with.
Yeah,
literally.
It's great.
The microwave cookbook is great because I can picture, you know, buying books for a cookbook section in a bookstore in 50 years, whatever the equivalent of Zoom is, people are using at that point, they will be talking about the
Instant
air fryer and Instant Pot cookbooks about food that should never have gone in either of those devices.
Yeah. Instant Pot's a little bit more, I can't tell which one's more self-aware. Instant Pot really is like, you can do everything here. Like put shoes in your oven, you know, get rid of your stovetop, just do everything in Instant Pot. It's like, I don't know if I want yogurt in the same place that I, you know, I'm doing like curries and things like that. Although I guess they overlap.
I'm very curious, and you know, it's kind of rare that we have a host where we can have a twofer because you guys are brothers, but for both Greg and Darren and then for Brianna, what was the music like in the kitchen when you were growing up? And how did that influence either your feeling about the kitchen or the music that you listen to now?
I mean, there was a lot of NPR in the mornings. I remember that was like when we first got up, it was NPR. And then it would switch over to, you know, Dad would play WXPN, which is 88.5 in Philadelphia. And that was a big mix of great music, like local Philly music and things like that. But then also you would get your Van Morrison and you would get your Santana, Fleetwood Mac, you know, Al Jarreau, things like that. It was a pretty eclectic mix. And then a lot of soul and Motown from my mom, our mom. So it was good, you know, or there'd be a Flyers game on, or PGA golf. It's pretty eclectic in the kitchen.
And Brianna, what sort of music was in the kitchen for you?
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up, my uncle was in a garage band in the Pacific Northwest in the 60s and still played music when I was a kid and had just like a basement full of instruments. And so he really influenced a lot of my music, but then also my dad really introduced me to most of the music that I ended up falling in love with, which was a lot of like The Police, The Who, Creedence Clearwater, and then getting into more like the Sonics, you know, my uncle had like a great jazz collection. So I remember the first time listening to like Miles Davis Kind of Blue, like at their house and hearing that for the first time and being, you know, probably 7, 8 and being introduced to that. So it was a lot of different mixes and pretty eclectic as well. Until I started being able to make my own choices, which I wouldn't recommend as much anymore.
Mm. Love the Sonics.
Yeah.
Holds up. Really holds
up. Absolutely.
So something that I found really fascinating about Snacky Tunes is how it is a cookbook in addition to being a collection of writing. And I was really curious from your editorial perspective, what was it like creating that part of the book? Have you made and tested and tasted all the recipes or?
If I had to do it all over again, I think the only restraint that I would put on it is to make sure that people at home could cook alongside to it or say like, this recipe should take as long as the playlist that you submitted. It was pretty much like the most important stuff for us in the book was the narrative and just getting those stories. Everything else was just like adding layers and layers and layers. So by the time we got to the recipe, it was like, please send whatever you would like. You've given us so much of your time. We don't want you to do it. And we also just like needed to be unpublished and tested. And could you do that? So we weren't able to test all of them, and some of them are quite complicated. And I would be impressed if anyone did at home. But what ended up being really great is that there are a strong number of from like beginner to medium home chefs that you can really put on one playlist, because all the playlists in the book live on Spotify. You can put on a playlist and then you're able to cook alongside it and then play another playlist when you serve it. I actually have a little bit of a different perspective because I like the range in there. We didn't put any, I like the fact that we didn't really give them any more guidance other than answer these questions, give us a playlist, and then give us the recipe. And I think it really speaks to the book where if you look at the music, there's definitely some easy entry pop music. They're like, I know that song. Like Bohemian Rhapsody's in there a couple of times, right? Like if you have a cursory knowledge of music or pop culture, you know that song, right? And then there's some like super deep South American cuts, and I have almost no working knowledge of South American music, and it takes a little bit more work, but it is a little bit more rewarding sometimes when you get to dig in and you're like, I know them as intimately as I know some of these pop songs. And I feel the same way about some of those recipes that are really complicated. Like Dominique Krenz is really a labor of love, and there's some other ones in there, but it's some of the rewards come from digging in a bit. And because we had to make it, they really could only represent themselves with one real recipe. It would have been, I was happy that we could just say like, pick whichever one you want and make story and song, whatever you want. Cause I think to them, like that's, you know, it's easier to judge someone on either a playlist or a recipe versus their narrative. And so I could feel like you picked it. We didn't push you into any corner. That's all you. So same, but they, I think a lot of them maybe lean more into caring more about the playlist because they rarely get to ever put out a public playlist more than the recipe.
Well, I think also it is very on brand for a Fiden cookbook to have some recipes that are out of the reach of a home chef as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, I have quite a few. I have the Elbow Lee cookbook and the Noma cookbook, and they're great to look at. I am not at that level. Not even close.
Well, like speaking of great to look at, I mean, I keep picking up the book and waving it around here, but it really is a beautiful book for anyone that hasn't been able to put their hands on it yet. It's got it's not quite like velour, but it's got a very pleasant kind of satin cover to it. And then the way that the text is laid out inside the book, if people can see from the screen there, is just really beautiful, for lack of a better way to put it. And I think
credit where credit's due, and that goes to our design partners, Omnivore. You know, we over-delivered. So originally they had said 50 chefs, and we came back, like I said, with 77 entries. And so when you essentially give over more than half of like what was promised, that's going to affect the design and could only really be text at that point. And Fiden picked incredible design partners, and they came back more or less with that. They allowed us to have some feedback, and I know that we went back and forth a little bit, but Omnivore, home run. And they picked the color too, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's really striking. It was nice to be able to use purple markers in the window of the store when we were making the display. So,
yeah, not a lot of purple cookbooks.
Yeah. And like, I think, again, from my perspective as a bookseller, we're really in kind of a golden age of cookbooks, in the sense that cookbooks are now something that have to exist as an object on your shelf that is appealing on its own, because people can go, you know, if you want just a recipe, if you want a recipe for baking a chicken breast or something like that, you can go online and search for that. So cookbook has to exist as this discrete thing with some personality. And Brianna, I wanted to ask you about the process for both your cookbooks, but particularly the Hunt and Alpine cookbook, what the process was in developing that from conception into a completed product.
Yeah, I mean, it was something we had actually never really thought or discussed doing. And we were approached by an editor saying, we want you guys to write a cookbook about Hunt and Alpine. So we took a few months and kind of did a back and forth deciding if we wanted to do a book and what it would look like and kind of what the overarching theme would be. And so after that, we just kind of went back to them and they said yes to everything we wanted, and we got the photographer we wanted, and it all just flowed very easily. And I don't feel like this is generally how books happen. So my perspective is a little different, I guess, or off. And I mean, I know from doing this, the newest book I'm doing, that this is generally not how books happen, because I'm getting a lot more feedback this time. But yeah, I mean, and, you know, it was something that, you know, we were so focused on Hunt. I was pregnant with our second kid, and we were opening another restaurant at the time. But I mean, my background's writing, and I worked, you know, in advertising and have written pieces and stuff and really focused on food for years. So it was hard for me to say no to what was my dream project and something I always wanted to do. But, you know, having to put it together, I think overall it took us about 2 years from conception to printing to have it done. So it was it was a long process.
And I think Josh, to your point, I always thought of this as like an artifact. You know, one, I think to go back to your question of like, why did we do this? No one came and asked us for this. We had done the podcast, which was so deeply intangible. You know, it's just something that exists on the internet, and you can't touch it. And you can, as Darren said, you can cross the 300 episode, 400, 500, 600 episode mark, and then that's kind of it. And we wanted to make something that existed as almost like a commemorative or alongside it, something that people could find and hold and discover, almost like a record, in a sense that you can have something that just sits on your dad or parent's shelves or mom's shelf. And 25 years later, you go into the attic and you're like, what is this? So a lot of the design, when Omnivore came back with it, I was like, this is something that can be discovered. And it doesn't necessarily need to tell you any way in. You can love it for the playlist or the recipes or for the narrative, but it's just something that sits alongside it. And it's not any one thing, but a collection of ideas and concepts. Mm.
And I want to, like, I think it's a terrible question to ask, like, what your favorite
No bad question.
But rather than ask what your favorite, you know, contribution was to the book, I'm curious, either what was the most surprising one in terms of the narrative answer, or what was the most surprising chef music matchup that felt like a mismatch or just a surprise?
Darren, Ben, should we tell the Ben story? I mean, but Ben, I mean, surprising is such, like, when you read the recipes and you look at the playlist and then you read their narrative, nothing surprising, right? Like, you really get to know, I mean, how much more do you need to know about a person is like, give me five of your favorite songs, give me a dish you like to make, and give me two stories from your life. And it's, you know, with social media today and the way that you get to peek into people's lives, especially chefs, right? Or people who are prolific on social media, like, oh, I sort of know you, right? And so it's very weird to get all these back because, you know, Greg and I split the interviews and the playlists and everything. And even the people who I didn't talk to or originally do, I was like, I sort of know you. Like, it's going to be weird when I meet you for the first time because it's a mix of some of our friends, right? People we've known forever. Some people who were past guests of the show. And then just some cold emails, right? Just some like, hey, we're doing this project. You don't know us, but we know you like music. And, you know, do you want to do this? And like those people who have never met in person and never really talked multiple times, I feel like I know them. So the pairings weren't really, really that up. I mean, I love someone like Mei Chow's journey in her life is really seen in her playlist. Like you get to see all of like what she discovered and living in Hong Kong and living in Boston and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, like your life narrative is the cadence of your playlist. So like that was really surprising and really great to see how intimate and open that people shared with us. I think the other thing too that I found is that now that it's been out there for a number of months, people have found avatars for themselves. So there's some chefs whose stories I think are super interesting and I just don't connect with at all. It's like, oh, that's, I appreciate that, but that's not for me. But there's some people like, you're me, your songs are me, your experiences are me, the way you see the world, like that's me. So there are some, when you say favorite, I think what we've found a better way to say it, and it's not a bad question because everyone has asked us that, it's what we found is that different chefs speak to different people. And so I tend to find like who spoke to whom, and it's always a different answer. It's always a different answer depending on where they are in their mindset when they're picking up the book to read.
Yeah, actually, if I could, I'll piggyback on that because, you know, the music scene, the food scene, especially because we're a little bit older. I mean, I don't know how it is when you're a teenager now, or when you're getting into any sort of scene, can be sort of rough at times to get in or exclusive. I mean, I think there's been, especially in the last year or so, in the food scene has taken a really hard look at it. The music scene, yes, but I wish there was more. But I think if you're into either one of these artistic pursuits of food and music, you can find commonplace and connection in this book. And that was really the theme we found throughout, was the connectivity of people. And so, you know, maybe you're in a smaller town, maybe you feel like, you know, you're not in sync with maybe what the rest of everyone else into, and you read a book or you hear a playlist or you see a story from this book and you're like, all right, there's a larger world out there. I mean, that was food and music for us. Music first, I would say, you know, going to basement shows and then seeing bands that were like on the road who were just like us from other towns. I was like, you can follow these pursuits and see a bigger world. And we hope that people see that in this book.
This episode is brought to you by Hot Dish Productions, an award-winning modern culinary production company specializing in creative digital video, photography, and podcast production. From concept through post-production, Hot Dish creates and produces compelling food stories that ignite the chef in all. Hot Dish Productions has deep connections to award-winning and celebrity chefs and over 20 years' experience. Their team has won both a James Beard Award and an IACP Award for their work in food media. Hot Dish Productions delivers the highest quality product at a fair value. Let them help tell your culinary story today. Explore their work and learn more at hotdishproductions.com.
So I have a question that anyone might have an answer to, or it may be unanswerable. It more in the respect of talking with bands rather than talking with chefs, which is, how do bands know the best restaurant to go to when they go into a town? Because it's something I've never figured out. And it seems like bands always seem to know where to go when they're on tour and they go into a town.
Well, there's a network. I mean, I think it used to be harder, right? Like, I think it used to be pre-internet, people just knew. I mean, there was less options, but people were just like, oh, if you're in this town, you tried this and that. I mean, now, if with a little bit of research and a little bit of elbow grease, you can find a good meal. But because I think food has become such a mainstream part and such like a important part of living, that the people who are booking, like the people who are running the shows, have a list of different type of restaurants. In the same way that if anyone ever came to town, whoever it is, to LA, I'd be like, you tell me the cuisine, you tell me what part of town, and we'll go knock it out.
One of our guest on the podcast, Adam Schatz of Landlady, made a website. It's tourfood.us, that if you're a driving band in the US, you can go from point A to point B and it will guide you to different restaurants. It was supposed to launch during the pandemic. Obviously it didn't, but it's a spreadsheet that he and his friend started in 2012. So now there's just resources for driving bands. I can put that in the chat too. And I think also one of the insights from Adam's interview was that there's two things that bands get to do on a show day: play a show, which is like an hour, yep, and they get to eat. And eating is usually more time and more significant than like a show, and, you know, depending where it is, or something new, you know, you're going to play the same set. So eating has become this like very big decision, besides like driving and getting somewhere. And Brianna, I know the combi oven was in there, but were there any detours that you made on your road trip for specific food places that was maybe like an extra 3 hours, but like we just might as well drive there?
Not like extra out of the way, but like we planned our trip definitely around places we wanted to eat as well, mm-hmm, and get food to go. And so, you know, it was and it being January, it was definitely a mad scramble to see if places were still open and doing to go food. But yeah, we stayed a couple days just outside Santa Fe so we could get like the enchiladas that we wanted to eat that we haven't had in 10 years. I definitely have driven 4 or 5 hours out of the way before three children to go eat a meal somewhere.
Yes. I mean, my daughter's godmother just drove across the country and she hit this vegetarian Indian food place in Oklahoma City at a truck stop. And I'm just like, I'll bank it, you know, whatever, who knows when. Right. But everyone just keeps a running list now. Right. I mean, you should see.
You got to put stars on your map. So if you read an article about a place, you can star your Google map.
yeah, you just got to put stars and just like, I mean, I have Google spreadsheets for places I've been, and then a working knowledge of maybe a couple dozen cities that I haven't been. And because other people travel, and just like, if you're just into just knowing where to eat, like even when you're on the road, like it's really tough to know that you've had a bad meal when there are great meals out there. And I think that that drives a lot of people. Like, it's like, like, did we get the right one spot? You know? And if you have that itch, and if you have that in the back of your mind, you will get one or two less hours of sleep the night before you drive to a place to find that that right, like, sandwich or taco or Thai takeout or pho, like, enchiladas. You just, it haunts you. Like, it's haunting. I don't know how to describe it. Like, it just burns me up. I was like, did we get the best possible
meal? All right.
Anyway, but that is what I think a lot of people, you know, look, when you're in a band and there's like four members, there's always going to be that one girl or guy who feels that same way. And like one person's in charge of tunes, one person's in charge of directions, and one person's in charge of food, right? And just trust the person who's in charge of food.
Well, talking about the best food, I think, is a great transition into talking about our fair city of Portland here. You were all kind enough to create a list of local beers paired with songs, which we have included in all the literature around the event. I'm drinking the Rising Tide Waypoint, which you paired with Cigarettes and Coffee by Otis Redding, and We at Print paired with Black Buck by Matteo Ascapore, which is a great new novel. But yeah, what is your relationship with the food in Portland? Do you have favorite restaurants? Have you been here to our fine city? Have you been to Hunt and Alpine?
I have been through Portland on the way to like a no-name place. My wife and I did our baby moon. So we stopped. We got a lobster on the way from a place that I regrettably did not do proper research on. But where we ended up, I know. We were like, you know, we were.
And you told like, me, when you told me, I went, he'll figure it out later.
Hold on.
He'll figure it out.
Hold on. And Brianna, my 5-month pregnant wife, was in the car and we just needed to get going. So we overshot Portland. We did end up getting a lobster roll at Red's, which I do say is like worth the drive and it was good. But what our fortunate was, and what I found that your incredible state has, is we were driving near our bed and breakfast and just saw a chalkboard sign that just said lobsters, cherry stones, and like turn right. And so we drove to a dead end of a street, and there was a shack called Allen's, third generation, that was just selling lobsters and cherry stones by the basket. So we ended up just cooking lobster every single night, and getting wine from a local shop, and like being like, we're coming back to Maine every single summer because it was just phenomenal. So we had one lobster roll, but the rest of it we just cooked ourselves because the produce and the lobster and the cherry stones were just so good that we felt that it would be a disservice to not try to figure out. We could do trial and error on the cooking, because like, you know, we can't do that here. So that's like my love affair with Maine, just like the bountifulness of being able to have food there, like would otherwise be like cost prohibitive, or just the quality would just be terrible.
We were in Maine years ago for a wedding, and we had an incredible lunch at Long Grain, which absolutely loved, you know, fresh ingredients, just incredible food, great, just local beers. And I always, I don't know, that meal and that afternoon always reminds me of like the best that Maine and sunshine and all that. And I was up in Bar Harbor and had a couple of delicious lobster rolls up there as well. A little bit about the beer and the playlist. So when we were picking the songs, we wanted like sort of some classic tunes, which is pretty much what we went with, just to sort of like, you put those songs on a playlist and just sit back on an afternoon and just crush some beers with some friends, which I think was the vibe that we're all hoping for midsummer this year. And so just like a good time, right? Like something classic, something fun, something that just, we tried to get a little cutesy and thematic with each of the beers and each of the songs. So either in the title or the content of the song matches the name or the ingredients of the beer. So a little twee, but nothing wrong with that.
And Brianna, I'd love to hear both about some Portland favorite, you know, main food, but also for people that don't know a little bit about both Hunt and Alpine and Verna's All Day, which as someone that goes through Waterville regularly, I'm very excited about.
Yeah, I mean, easy main food to love is the lobster. And I always recommend to people, if you have access to just buy fresh lobster and cook it yourself, I feel like that's the truest main experience. And that's what I love. And when friends come from visit from out of town, you know, I'm always like, look how cheap the lobster is. And we
it's
make
crazy.
too much lobster. One of my best friends used to live in LA, and she was like, we bought like 7 or 8 for like the 3 of us to eat. And she was like, how much was this? Can I help? And I was like, no, it's like $80. We're good. Where like one would be that much for her.
I know.
You know, and so that and oysters and like getting a little kit and shucking your own oysters or going to one of the oyster farms and just having them like right out of the water, I think is perfect. But I also, if we're going to talk about Maine, we have to talk about Allen's Coffee Brandy. And I think it is that it's made in Massachusetts, but has been for many, many years one of the most, it's a coffee flavored liqueur. And Josh, you've probably had it more than me, I might guess, only because I've only ever had it once.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've had it.
It is called the Champagne of Maine.
You could have added some digits to that number and I still would have had it more than you.
Yeah.
It's called the Champagne of Maine. It's like $11 for a full handle of it. It has been up until Fireball just recently beat it out as the top selling spirit in Maine. And it carries in the top 10, it has many places in there because of the variety of UPC symbols. But it's one of those things that's, I think is a Maine classic. And one, if you're coming to visit Maine, I always recommend. It's called Allen's Coffee Brandy. And
I'm
actually
totally getting that.
At Hunt and Alpine, it might be hard to find in Louisiana.
We'll order it over state lines. Our grandmother makes a Hungarian chocolate cake that has chocolate liqueur in it. And it's always been the most generic kind of like, you know, it's fine. This sounds like the perfect replacement for it. So I'm like very, very, I've been on like a hunt for like something better. So like this sounds like fits very much into our family repertoire.
It'll hit you. I mean, and this is like one of those things that I like lobstermen would go out in the morning and with their coffee, do a hefty splash of Allen's. We actually use it in our espresso martini at Hunt and Alpine. That's Andrew, my husband,
Allen's
created.
Allen's Coffee Ready. Will you put in the chat?
Yeah, I can. I'll put the recipe in there for you guys.
Amazing.
But
by the way,
in
that thing of cost, I remember the first time that I ever had a cherry stone was at a seafood place in New York, and it was $4 for one. And I was like, oh, mm-hmm. This is amazing. This is incredible. And when I was in Maine, I got a pound for $4.
Yeah.
And I was like, I will never forget that ratio. I feel both taken and like valued at the same time, knowing that it's like a 1 pound to one cherry stone from the Maine.
Yeah, but it's the transportation, right? It's just like it's getting it from you. It's getting if you get to go to an oyster farm and ever cross that check off your bucket list, getting that fresh oyster and keeping it fresh from you to New York or anywhere is like a lot of money, a lot of gas. So.
Yeah,
Brianna, do you have a favorite song to shuck oysters to? What's your oyster shucking playlist like?
Oh, it would probably be something Bill Withers, like When I'm Kissing My Love or something, because I feel like there's just like a really nice beat to it. So it'll kind of get you in the, because like, especially if you're shucking a lot of oysters, you want to have like a little bit of flow to it. So you don't, you know, stab your own hand or, you know, mess up the oysters
catch that
too
rhythm.
Much. Yeah. So that's the first thing that came to my head. So that's what I picked.
Although, I've seen professional Maine oyster shuckers, and they move really quickly.
Oh yeah,
But they also have the chainmetal. They have the chainmetal glove on.
Yeah,
they're going at a different speed.
Yeah, they're listening to Black Flag, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's the rhythm you want when you're spearing an oyster, right?
just some four to the floor blast beat drums. Just
I ripping. Like the joy of learning the difference between a oyster and a clam knife when I was up there as well, which is like a difference that I tried to like, I was like, what's the difference? And then when I ate no cherry stones on that first night and went out and bought an oyster knife on the second, or a clam knife on the second night, I was like, oh, that's the difference. Got it.
Well, I'm just taking a look at the time now and seeing that we are getting close enough to the end that I want to make sure we don't skip out on the audience questions. So one, for starters here is, what are some of your favorite other culinary related media, be it food, be it podcasts or TV or books?
Well, I'm going to shout out Darren because Darren works at Tastemade and is a phenomenal director. And so I'd say that anything that Darren puts his hands on is really worthwhile watching. And I'm completely biased and it is completely, fully vetted.
I will thank you for the compliment, and I'll pay it forward to any podcast on Heritage Radio Network, which has been our home for 12 years. We've just met so many incredible, like-minded people. I mean, one of our good time friends and she does a show all about cookbooks, Kathy Irway, just longtime friend. And she does such a great show. And then Carrie Diamond, shout out to Carrie Diamond, who runs, Cherry Bomb, who we absolutely love and met when she was still in her coach days, and she would book us to DJ at store events up on 57th. Which was,
she does not want any of that history out there, I promise.
Oh, well, it's out there. And anyway, but we met her and she's great. So a lot of people like that. I mean, I do a lot of hunting for like some really weird stuff. And so there's always like Vimeo actually, I would say probably has the best like obscure, weird food art stuff, more so than YouTube. So if you ever want to go down rabbit holes, just hit me up. You know, there's a lot of great stuff out there.
I'll also second both Tastemade and Heritage Radio Network are both two outlets I have been fans of for many years and have friends working at Heritage who have done stuff, some really cool stuff there. Also, I think there's a lot of great food writers doing Substacks right now. I have like way too many that come into my inbox that I want to spend more time with, but it's like a really great way and that you can like support writers directly, which is really nice. And I just started watching Waffles and Moki on Netflix, which is
Michelle. It's
really incredible.
It's really good.
And I mean, even if you don't have kids, I think you could totally watch it. But I have a 3 and a 6-year-old, so it's something nice that we can all watch together. And I'm not wanting to poke my eyes out, so that's always a win for me.
And can we just do a general shout out to anyone who has still managed to hang on being a food writer in the last year? I think, we focus a lot on the restaurants and everything that got crushed, but, you know, all the writers who were doing coverage or out there and things like that, who were able to keep it up either through their jobs or through independent work now, because some of the going outs of anything has folded and it's continued to like shine a spotlight on the emerging businesses or the business they're hanging on. It's a grind at another level, but we'd be very lost without them.
100%. The best American food writing that came out this year from Mariner, all of the content was set, but not the introduction before COVID hit. So it's a very interesting time capsule because the content does not really reckon with the pandemic, but the introduction was written, I think, a couple months into it happening, starting. So it's a very interesting time capsule, but yeah, like good food writing is hard to beat. And yeah, hopefully a lot of these writers are able to make it through in publications as well.
You bring up an interesting point because we were wrapping the book at the beginning of the pandemic, right, Greg? Like March, I think it was, or April.
Yeah, we were doing the final edits in April.
In April. And so we had we had a pretty good idea of where this was going with the industry and like how this was not, you know, anyone who has been part of the food industry the previous up until March of last year, it was an insane golden age. And we make a joke about like, how do you know where to eat in town when you drop into a town? Well, it's sort of hard pressed to go into any town now and not find a good meal, right? And like, you know, that wasn't always a given. And so in many ways, this book is a love letter and a bit of a timestamp and a dedication to like what those last 10 to 15, 20 years of restaurants were, which is you walk in and there's a vibe and there's music and there's dishes and there's conversation and stories, which feels like, you know, like a fantasy now in some ways, or something from yesteryear. But we hope that people see the book and see the stories and be like, this is a roadmap to a guide to, you know, what was maybe sometimes we, you know, we'd be at a meal and you'd roll your eyes like, oh, another course or another thing or something like that. I'll never roll my eyes again being out to eat, you know, put on another song, bring out another dish, have another glass. Like, so, you know, there's a lot of yearning now when I sometimes read different sections of the book. They're like, oh yeah, I miss that.
And another audience question here, there's a slightly longer one, so my apologies, I'm going to try to get the gist of it here, is that, you know, musical scenes and culinary scenes can have hostile, exclusionary elements under the guise of having to pay your dues or something like that, and have larger than life celebrities and personalities. In producing your show, is that something that you've had to deal with either as fans or as professionals? And has it altered the way that you interact with bands or with chefs?
Very simply put, we only tried to work with, we're not like a gotcha podcast. Like, we're not trying to get anyone. So if we didn't like them or like it was going to go down a dark path, we just wouldn't book them. We just want to, there's a lot of amazing people doing incredible work that normally don't get a light shine on them, or that very, very little. So we would just rather just put people on that we knew were good people. I mean, obviously some people, I'd have to go back and look through the 475 episodes, and I'm sure some of the people have probably not fed it out well. And I definitely know a project that we did that we went back and edited out some people who were not good in the light of the day, if you will. But in general, Darren and I have tried just to work with good people. And if we didn't like them, we just wouldn't have them on. So we could just have like very happy, engaging conversations. But I think I can put it on less than, after 12 years, less than two hands of situations. Like in the moment, we were like, wow, those people were like not great. And we could still tell those stories years later because no one came and replaced how bad they were just based on our booking.
I think I could think of one food guest and one band. And Greg, I wonder if you can read my mind afterwards. And we did have to sunset archive a couple of the episodes, especially some stuff that came out both post Me Too, post George Floyd. Like, you know, I mean, look, you have that many guests on, not everyone's going to look great. But we don't change, like, we've been lucky enough to have some really big guests on. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, we've had some of the biggest chefs in the world on, and that's just come from, you know, just being around and always showing up and doing the work and being part of the cycle. But we haven't chased a lot of people. And I think that comes through where it's like, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. When we sat down with Massimo for the first time, we were both like, I can't believe this is happening. And it's awesome. But it wasn't like we set out to sit down with Massimo from day one. And I think that's a difference. And so when it happens, you know, I got to sit down with Wolfgang Puck right after he did his Oscar preview for one of the food things. And I was like, I can't believe I'm here talking with him. And if you thought I'm name dropping now, listen to that interview, because it is the most amazing like name dropping story of like the 70s and 80s. But it happens, you know, and Kong has been a really great producer as well. But I think we do it for the right reasons, because we love what these people are about, and we're just honored to like share some space with them.
Well, I think that is a great note to start wrapping up on here. And also, just like, kudos, it is astounding. 11 years now, more than 11 years of wow, doing this show. Yeah. I wasn't sure when in 2009, 2021.
Yeah.
It's, astounding, and it's an incredible catalog for anyone that wants to go back and listen as a companion to,
again, we're all there
here, this spectacular book. I think of a final question, which is a straightforward one for everyone, and we can go in whatever order, is what's the last thing you cooked, and what were you listening to when you cooked it?
Darren, you want to go first?
Yeah, there's this famous place near where we live called Roma Market, which got a big push over the summer because they make this thing called the sandwich. It's like this 70-year-old guy who does this one Italian sandwich. You just say, I want the sandwich. And they have a great frozen section of homemade tortellini and sauce. And so I was cooking that up and listening to an old Volt, Otis Redding. It was like the story of Otis Redding. And it's banger after banger after banger of Otis Redding songs. That was Sunday night. That was last night.
Well, man, we are twins because I also listened to that Otis Redding thing. Not the last thing I listened to, but it's the XY podcast from Spotify that Leslie Odom Jr. does of his deep dive into Otis Redding and Sam Cooke, which is amazing. The last thing that I cooked is I got my hands on The Good Book of Southern Baking, which is by Kelly Fields, who's Willa Jean, owns Willa Jean's in New Orleans. And has this phenomenal, I've been doing trading between her cornbread and her chocolate chip cookie, which is just dangerous to have in the house. And I always listen to something like Max Richter or Philip Glass when I'm baking, just because it's really meditative. And I'm a very confident cook and a very nervous baker. So I need something very relaxing on to make sure that I'm measuring correctly and not mixing the step, but those two combined makes me very happy.
And a spectacular cookbook. It came out the end of last year, right? Good Book of Southern. Yeah.
Literally worth every penny. Her recipes are flawless. Flawless. I was like, there's no way this is going to work. I don't understand these steps. Things are put in the fridge for 24 hours, et cetera. It's just great. It's just great.
Brianna?
Yeah, so I had two writing deadlines this morning, so I decided to make everything bagel bombs for the first time and with my own recipe. So I spent all morning doing that today and listening to, it was a playlist that was a mix of the Magnetic Fields and the Ramones.
Awesome.
So the bagel bombs were just okay. I got to work on them more.
the differential cadence and tempo of those two bands, really just going back and forth.
I like baking in a little bit of chaos. So
yeah,
it's good.
Yeah. Favorite Ramon song?
I Want to Be Your Boyfriend. It's just such a good love song.
Yeah.
So simple.
I Just Want to Walk Around with You. Their love songs are the best.
Yeah, they are. They're really good.
They're just like, yeah, like, let's just hang out. Let's just be together.
Yeah.
Havana Affair. There we go. Another great one.
I love it. Yeah.
Thank you, Gracie.
Summertime
also,
is always.
Also, can we just say thank you to Gracie for organizing this and putting us all together.
And thank you to all the breweries. If any of you breweries want to send some beer to California, you just let me know.
Well,
thank you, Josh. Great moderating. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for doing this. It was such a, again, this was such a treat for me, having enjoyed the book so much. And again, Brianna, knowing you and the relationship you have with us in the store, this was just a dream come true. So thank you all for doing this. The book, again, is Snacky Tunes, which we have linked to both in the chat here and on our website and through a QR code in the window at the store. So there's no excuse for you not to pick up the book. And the Hunt Alpine Cookbook and the Wonder Woman Official Cookbook, are those titles correct, Brianna? Or Northern Hospitality, I'm so sorry. Yeah. But yeah, and thank you to the audience for coming. And everyone have a great night. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thanks
for having
us. Bye.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.